And this is also, okay, so the title of the talk is The Henry Brown Twist Effect, and I'm going to tell you a lot about what that is, if you don't already know. It's worthwhile knowing. And this is another lame joke having to do with a pretty red caboose that I happened upon on vacation in a railroad museum, which had the right initials on its on the caboose. But that's not very important either. So now you can start. Now it starts to get important. So here's the outline of the talk. It's very quick. It's first, most of the talk will be about the traditional Henry Brown twist effect as it was discovered and as it was used to measure things about astronomical, make astronomical measurements. And I'll talk a little bit about the history of the effect because it's how it came, how people thought about it, because it's very amusing and instruction, educational to think about that. And then I'll talk a little bit, but I won't belabor it too much, I hope, about what I do is doing this Henry Brown twist effect for other types of waves, namely de Broglie waves. And so one way to think about this is to think about it as a, is this making too much? I was just about to talk about noise. what the Henry Brown twist effect is a way to think, a fruitful way to think about it is it's a noise measurement. And so whenever I think about this, I am reminded of this this little quote by Ambrose Bierce from the 19th century, which somebody pointed out to me. Noise is the chief product and authenticating sign of civilization. This was intended very sarcastically, obviously, but for us physicists, noise is actually, if you don't already think so, I hope by the end of the talk, I hope I can convince you that the study of noise is a very, very noble and civilized endeavor. Ambrose Bierce notwithstanding. And the first noble and civilized example I'm going to talk about is that of Einstein. Einstein actually often had many, many times in his career thought about noise, or more precisely, fluctuations. And many different, the most famous perhaps being the analysis of Brownian motion. And I was, a lesser known example is one that occurs in one of his famous papers in which he discussed the theory of the ideal Bose gas. And the most famous thing about these papers is that he discovered Bose-Einstein condensation, or predicted Bose-Einstein condensation. And if you read this paper, there's an interesting paragraph, it's less than a page of this long set of papers, in which he thinks about number fluctuations. So he thinks he imagines an ideal gas, an ideal quantum gas, which has these new statistics, and some sort of subvolume inside it, and asks, well, how many atoms will I find, or molecules will I find inside this gas? And then asks about the fluctuations of this gas. So he talks about a variance where these averages are meant to mean be ensemble averages of identically prepared systems in which I take a little subvolume and I count how many atoms are in this subvolume and I calculate a variance. So the variance is defined in this way. It is the difference between the average of the square minus the square of the average. And through a thermodynamic argument that's not difficult at all, he arrives at this formula, that this variance has two pieces, a linear piece and a quadratic piece. And in it appears a quantity which has h-bar in it, which is the number of elementary phase space cells occupied by this box. So it depends on the size of the box, the spatial size of the box, as well as the temperature of the gas. So he gets this formula. And it's not very difficult at all to derive. But it's very interesting. And he makes a number of comments. The first is that, well, this linear term is what you would get if the molecules were independent. It is what we now call shot noise. Okay, it's what you get if you have some sort of Poissonian distribution of stuff like rain falling on a roof. And you look at the fluctuations of that, the variance of the number of hits that you of the rain on the roof that you measure will scale as the number, or the standard deviation will scale as the square root. So that's That's very normal. That's to be expected. But then there's this other term, which she says, well, if this were radiation, this would correspond to what he calls interference fluctuations. The German word is nice and long. That's the German word for you German experts that he used in the paper. All right, and I'll explain, if that's not obvious to you, I'll explain, that'll become a little more obvious later on in the talk, what he means by interference fluctuations. And he says, well, these two things are there, but they're sort of strange because one thing has to do with sort of independent molecules, and this thing is some sort of wave effect. And he's already putting his finger on this wave-particle duality that's a little strange. And goes on further to comment that, well, this term is kind of strange. And he refers to it as being due to a mutual influence between the molecules of a currently altogether puzzling nature. And it's palpable, at least to me, that this bugs him. And it should bug you too. And I hope it will bug you more and more as the talk goes on. and that's good. There's the German, how he said it in German. All right, so that's Einstein. And now I'm going to shift gears completely and talk about astronomy. And we'll see what this has to do with astronomy later. And in particular, I want to talk about the first measurements that were done to attempts to get at the angular size of stellar objects, of stars. And the first attempt to do this, or at least the first successful attempt, is due to Michelson and his associates in the 20s, where they built the following apparatus. On a big telescope, he built an extra bit that had two collection mirrors, which then sent the light onto this mirror and essentially made a Young's double slit experiment, whose fringes appear here and could be looked at by an observer. Okay? And in a museum in which telescope? In the Mount Wilson telescope? There's actually the device is still there, and you can look at this thing he built to implement this idea. And the idea is that you ought to look at these fringes, and if the source, the distant star, is angularly small enough, you'll see fringes. But if it's too big relative to this separation d, the fringes will go away because you can think of the Young's fringes will have some position. If the star moves, the fringes will move. If the star has a size, the fringes, you will add up many fringes, and at some point they will wash out, and they'll wash out when the size of the star is of order, the wavelength that you're looking at, divided by this distance. So you could change this. It was built in such a way that you could change this distance d and then try to identify the contrast of the Young's fringes that you see. Okay, and it was a tour de force, an experimental tour de force at the time, and he actually managed to measure the angular diameters of six of the biggest stars in the sky. And it was quite remarkable. This work was later, and it was very difficult, in part because the angular size of the star was not the only thing that ruins the fringe contrast. Stuff moves. If the mirrors move, that's very bad. The atmosphere moves because it's fluctuating. And so it was a really tough experiment. It's now been repeated, and it's a big business in astronomy to do essentially this measurement on much bigger baselines using adaptive optics to get rid of this motion. But I'm just interested in the principle for now. Okay, so this is a great step forward in observational astronomy. And now another one that gets closer to my interests for today is due to this fellow here, Robert Henbury Brown, who was originally a radio or a radar engineer, spent the war doing that, and then got interested in radio astronomy, and from radio astronomy went to optical astronomy, and had the following insight. He said that, well, if you make two telescopes like this, and you put detectors for optics, the idea is to have a photomultiplier tube, or if it's in the radio, some sort of radio detector, which converts the intensity of the radiation into an electrical current, I. His idea was, well, the noise I see in these two telescopes, as reflected in these two photocurrents, will be correlated if this distance d is small enough compared to the angular size of the star. And the formula governing that is exactly the same as Michelson's. And what I have to do to measure that thing is to take these two currents, these two macroscopic photocurrents, and put them in a correlator, basically a device, a nonlinear device, which will tell me the product of these two currents, and then average them over some averaging time, long compared to the fluctuations. So mathematically, or the sensitivity to the angular size looks exactly like Michelson's, except for maybe a factor of two or something. But first of all, it seems to have some big advantages. It was much less sensitive to vibrations of the devices or atmospheric fluctuations. So one could hope to do this over much longer distances d than Michelson was able to do. The other important point is that it's kind of weird because it's not obvious to see that what this has to do with interference. There are just two currents. I'm turning light into currents, and the currents are fluctuating. And what does that have to do with Michelson's experiment? And maybe that will become clear as we go. In any case, when Henry Brown suggested this, well, actually, he first actually succeeded in doing it in the radio. But when he proposed to do it at an optical telescope and perform this type of measurement, people didn't believe him, and people wouldn't give him money to do it, saying that this can't possibly work, because there are these, for the reasons that I'm saying. And this impelled Henry Brown to collaborate with Mr. Twiss on a laboratory demonstration of the principle. Okay, so here's the figure from their paper. There's a bright and narrow bandwidth light source, but just a light. It's not a particularly remarkable light. There's a slit here, and here there's a beam splitter, which in those days was called a half-silvered mirror. And because I guess they actually just had a piece of glass that they put a little silver on. And then they had two photomultiplier tubes that were arranged in this configuration in such a way that the image of one could be superimposed with the other. Okay, and then this thing could be moved back and forth, and that would correspond to changing the separation between the two detectors. Okay, and it's also very charming that the draftsman actually put the crank that moves the detector back and forth into the picture. And then there's this electrical circuit, this correlator, that basically just takes the product of these two photocurrents. And they did that, and they moved this back and forth, and they measured the degree of correlation as a function of this separation, and here is an example of their data. And they saw a nice correlation. I didn't check in their paper, but I suppose this separation really does correspond to the angular size of the source as defined by this pinhole and this distance. And so what they said, the experiment was to respond to their critics, their reviewers, that the experiment they've done shows beyond question that the photons in the two coherent beams of light are correlated, and that this correlation is preserved in the process of photoelectric emission. People didn't believe him, but now they had to believe him. And so he managed to get enough funding to, in the year after that, to actually use this on a real star. So a year later, he does the same measurement, but with telescopes and photomultipliers connected to the telescopes. He gets practically the same data, the difference being that the D, instead of being measured in millimeters, is now in meters. And from this, you can easily get out an angular size for this star Sirius, which is really awfully darn small, and is smaller than anything that that Michelson was able to measure with his technique. And so it demonstrates that even from a star, you get this correlation effect. And if you it's still very bothersome to think that, well, I've got these photons that are coming from the surface of this star. It's 5,000 degrees. It's thousands of kilometers in diameter. And the photons somehow get to the detectors, and they know about each other. And how did they do that? And this was very puzzling and bothersome to people at the time. And indeed, had Einstein been alive, it might have been bothersome to him as well, because it's this puzzling mutual influence between the particles that's happening here. The Brits, I guess, didn't want to give him money to keep going, but he went to Australia, and then this became a big business for him. He spent many years, of order a decade, in Australia building this device here, where he had two telescopes on a circular track with electronics and everything, and then performed these correlation measurements, and managed to measure the diameters of 32 stars in the southern sky with baselines going up to 200 meters. So it was big progress, I think. Now, before talking, I want to talk about what this has to do with quantum mechanics and quantum gases and what Einstein was thinking about. But before that, I'm going to just walk you through, you might not need it, but some of you might need to be reminded, of walk you through the classical explanation of how this can happen. So forget about photons, and let's just have electromagnetic waves which travel from a source to a detector, all right? And let's just think about these sources as being a bunch of little point radiators which radiate light with some definite phase. And you can easily mock that up in the laboratory by having some sort of ground glass screen and shining a laser at it. And what do you get at a distant screen? You get speckle, all right? And this is very easy to do. In fact, very, very hard to avoid in many cases. You just need a laser, and you need some dirty piece of optics, right? And if you do this, and you shine light at it, instead of seeing a pretty laser beam, you see this apparently random interference pattern, okay? And if you move this around, it changes. And there's a really weird thing about speckle. Those of you who wear glasses, you see, if you're looking at them, you see very nice fine points. If you take your glasses off, they're still nice fine points, even though the rest of the room is not very nice and fine. but it's completely a classical effect how to explain that. And here's a little more explanation. So if you do this, what you see is this random pattern, which I intend to represent the speckle, even though statistically this doesn't have the right properties, but it's my drawing program couldn't do any better. What you get, so on this screen you get this fluctuating thing, and the important thing about this is that, or an important thing about this, is that these fluctuations do not happen at all length scales. There's a characteristic length scale for these fluctuations. And this length scale is closely related to the angular size of the source. So the source size divided by the distance. And I have another slide to explain that to you, but, well, you can you shouldn't find that too shocking, this formula. But you can see that the same Michelson's formula is there too, and this is what's going to give you the handle to get the angular size of the source out of this technique. And the argument goes like this: well, what you measure is the product of two intensities as two different points, at a point x and a point x plus delta x. It's convenient to normalize it, but that's a technical point. The important thing is that if this delta x is big compared to this correlation length, then it's as if you were multiplying together two completely independent quantities. Oh, and by the way, one is taking an average here. And for the moment, you can just think of this average as being an average over x. So I take this point and another point some distance away, and then I take the whole business and I move it along the screen, and I average over all possible x's. So if I do that, if the x is large, it's as if everything will happen as if these two fluctuating quantities are independent, and so the average of the product is equal to the product of the average. However, if I let x be very small, that is to say smaller than this correlation length, that's about the size of this bump here, then it must be that the average of the square be greater than the square of the average. And that's simply sort of the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality. Okay? It's because a fluctuating thing, every time it goes up, I square it, and every time it goes down, I square it. I'm getting myself in trouble here. I hope this is obvious. And in particular, so if you go back to Einstein's argument, Einstein took a particular case of a thermal source. He actually also thought about this for thermal radiation, not just a thermal quantum gas. And you can show that in that case, this formula is actually, more specifically, this one here, that the average of the square is twice the square of the average. All right, so you can recover this formula or one little piece of Einstein's formula just based on classical electromagnetism if you include a little bit of statistics and the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality. What else did I want to say? No, I guess that's all. And so then I can sort of think of plotting this function, this G2 function. If you don't know why there's a 2, it's not important, but this is the jargon of quantum optics, is that you call this G2. If you plot this as a function of this separation, you therefore expect to find, for this kind of a source, a thing that's equal to 2 at small distances, and then it falls off to something that's equal to 1 at very large distances, and it falls off in some characteristic way that may or may not be interesting. And this is the basis of Henry Brown's idea, except that what he does is, instead of averaging over x, one does a temporal average. Okay, so now what we have to imagine is that these sources are not fixed, but that their phases somehow fluctuate because the atoms collide, they move, the sources move. And if you allow these phases to fluctuate, this speckle pattern will fluctuate, like this, right? You are not surprised that this fluctuates, right? and then all I need to do to perform this average is put the detectors at two points and wait. And now this average, instead of being a spatial one, is a temporal one. And the Henry Brown twist experiment is to do it that way. Okay, you fix the two points and just do a temporal average with the correlator. And you do that, and you measure this correlation length, and that gives you the angular size of the star, and that's the principle of Henry Brown Twiss's experiment. So he did this. It's then amusing to note that you can do a very similar thing in the time domain. You can think of just having a single detector and having I1 and I2 be the intensities at different times. in which case you can, you can define a similar quantity, which would be G2 of some delta T, and then watch how the correlation dies away temporally. And knowing that correlation time is telling you something about how fast these things, these phases move, all right? And here is where the cosmetics industry comes in, if you read my little blurb for the talk. In the cosmetics industry, one wishes to measure sizes of very small particles. Why? Because you put them in face creams to give them the right texture. And so you have to have metrology for little tiny beads that you want to put into some viscous liquid, for example, water, which, no, we don't need this. For example, water, whose viscosity you know, in which case, no, a measurement of the diffusion coefficient will tell you the particle size. All you need to know is the particle size and its viscosity. And you can measure this diffusion coefficient by looking at these correlations and seeing how they decay. It so happens with a diffusive motion, they decay exponentially. And here you see a plot of data taken with different particles, different particle sizes. And you see there's a dramatic change in the correlation time of this source. Right. This is a much easier experiment to do than Henbury-Brown's because the bandwidth is really small, so it's possible to actually get out the correlation time. When you're looking at a star, the correlation time is really, really fast, and a big problem with the Henbury-Brown twist type of experiment is that the faster the electronics, the better, and you have to work hard on speeding that up. Okay. So now let's talk about quantum mechanics. So because that's a big problem, because classically we see how that all works, but what is it about these photons that come from different places that never saw each other and land at separated detectors and somehow know about each other afterwards, after all? And this bugged people when the experiment came out. And I think the first really good explanation is due to Fano in this paper, which I recommend, or at least I recommend the first couple of pages, in which he, he gives in words the argument, which is very easy to follow, very, very lucid. And then he goes there's another 10 pages of horrible calculations, which I cannot get through. Although I know where he's going, and I know what he's up to. The idea is, well, if I want to talk about a correlation, I'm necessarily talking about detecting about two detectors, detecting particles at two different photons at two different places. So I have to think about the probability that a photon gets emitted from point A and gets detected in detector one, and one gets emitted from point B and goes to detector two. And this, quantum mechanically, I can write as this kind of an amplitude. But when I do that, I must also consider the possibility that this happened, that the point A emitted a photon that was detected at point two, and B went to point one. And if these two possibilities are indistinguishable, if there's no way in principle of telling which of these two things happened, then the total probability has to be, I need to sum these two amplitudes, and what I get is an interference term, which after I average over the entire source, will only persist if the separation between these two detectors is small enough. And I get exactly the same formula as we got before, and Fano went through the whole argument and made sure you really get the same answer. And so what you see is that an effect which is classically very simple is actually hiding a rather more subtle quantum one. If you insist on thinking about this as photons, you have to accept the fact that these photons are not independent, that you have to deal with two particle amplitudes, which you usually don't have to do when you're doing ordinary interferometry. Then there's another interesting point. The same argument, well, you can probably, well, if you try to do this for fermions, you ought to get, even though photons are not fermions, you ought to get a minus sign here. And so what you will see is in the back of this is something to do with the symmetrization and anti-symmetrization of wave functions. Although that can be formulated in a much more rigorous way, which I will do in a bit. Okay, so that looked very good. Along came, and this is the year after the laser was invented. And so people started asking, well, all right, now what if I do this with a laser? Lasers are great because, for one thing, they're intense sources of light that have very narrow bandwidth. And narrow bandwidth is good for detecting these correlations because it means correlation times are long. And so it ought to be really, and they're very coherent, and they're very, shouldn't they be very correlated as well? And some people in the literature said, yes, this would be a great thing to do. We'll see a lot of nice correlations by doing this kind of the Hendra-Vogt twist experiment with a source being the laser. Except that in 63, Roy Glauber threw cold water over all of this and said, no, 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 this will not work. And here are his actual words. The fact that photon correlations are enhanced by narrowing the spectral bandwidth has led to the prediction of large-scale correlations to be observed in the beam of an optical maser. Another anachronism there, but. We shall indicate this prediction is misleading and follows from an inappropriate model of the laser beam. It's a little complicated, his argument. Before I do that, I will simply show you the first experiment in which actually successfully measured, I think it's the first one, that successfully or unambiguously measured the correlations in a laser. And this line here corresponds, from this paper here, corresponds to the correlation signal observed using a helium neon laser. And it was shown that this correlation function, now in the time domain, was totally flat, no correlations at all, in spite of it being a laser. Sort of the quick hand-waving explanation of that is, well, a laser doesn't fluctuate. A laser has a very stable intensity, and so it's not surprising that you don't get big fluctuations. That's sort of a classical argument. You'd like to make that a little more quantum mechanical, and that's what Roy Glauber did. And it's a little bit nasty because you have to write down quantized fields and then write down expectation values of a lot of operators, and it very quickly gets to be a big nasty calculation that I won't do in front of you. But it's very beautiful because by just using quantized fields and thinking carefully about what it means to detect one or two photons, he identified the appropriate quantum mechanical operator for joint two-photon detection probabilities and recovered a formula that looks very similar to, that recovers Einstein's formula, which contains a term that is linear in the intensity and a term that is quadratic in the intensity. And if using a thermal source, this expectation value, which means you have to take an expectation over all these different operators where I, J, K, and L correspond to different modes, it gives you two terms here, which essentially amount to the factor of two that we saw earlier in the Hendra-Vogt twist effect. Right? And the explanation for the laser is that, well, what's going on is for a laser, you don't have many modes. There's only one. And so this expectation value doesn't get a two, it just gets a one. Right? And that's the reason, the quantum mechanical reason, why this factor of two in the Hendra-Vogt twist effect goes away when you do it with a laser. So that's all I have to say about quantum optics. And now I'm going to move on, but don't worry, it'll be fairly quick, to doing this with other kinds of waves. And my favorite waves are de Broglie waves made of atoms. So here is the group of people that have been working on this over the past few years. These are former students, and this is approximately the present composition of the group. And what we've been working on is an atom, the metastable helium atom. This is our favorite atom. And what's so great about the metastable helium atom is that it's got this ground, well, helium has this ground state here, which is familiar to anybody who's ever played with balloons. But if you stick it in a discharge, you can excite the first electronically excited state is this triplet state, 20 electron volts above the ground state, and which in vacuum has only a very, very highly forbidden transition to the ground state. The lifetime of this transition is 8,000 seconds. In spite of this metastability, once it hits a metal surface, all the symmetry rules that prevent this thing from decaying go out the window, and the thing decays very quickly. It emits this 20 electron volts in the vicinity of the surface, which is available to then ionize something, rip out an electron from a metal surface, and that can be amplified and by, for example, a microchannel plate. So this is the apparatus we've built. There's a cold gas. These are magnets that make the trapped gas. We won't go into the details of how you make this gas. And then we have this fancy detector, which consists of a microchannel plate, which is then has a fancy anode that uses delay lines to actually get position resolution. So we don't only know when the atom hits, we know where it hits, to within something like 500 microns. And this will allow us to do the equivalent of the Henbury-Brownick twist experiment, but we're going to be able to do it instead of with two detectors, we're going to do it with 10 to the fourth detectors. And this will be very useful in the future. The actual apparatus looks like this, or a piece of it looks like this. The detector is actually buried underneath all this stuff here. It's in this big vacuum can. But that gives you the scale. And Martin Shelkins and Valentina Krasmalnikov are there to show you how big the apparatus is and how difficult it is to align. No, really, it was a hard experiment, and these two are very, very clever people. I was very lucky to have them work on this experiment. And so the way the experiment works, once again, is we got these atoms that are trapped in this source S, okay? And at some point, we turn the source off, the atoms fall down, and then they go through this detector plane, and the detector makes clicks, 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 and tells us X, Y, and time for every single atom. Every single atom except for the fact that the quantum efficiency is only of order 10%, which is unfortunate, but not a showstopper. Okay, so when you do that, what do you see? So on the top graph, you can see a very basic thing, just the arrival time distribution, or the density of particles for a given momentum. All right, they fall down. And once they've fallen down, the time of their arrival tells you what their initial momentum must have been. The reason is the distance of the arrival, the distance they fall is so large that the size of the source plays no role in where they hit or when they hit. And so you get this more or less Gaussian distribution of arrival times. These are milliseconds. The velocity is about 3 or 4 meters per second, so you can convert milliseconds into millimeters, if you like. So anybody can do this. This has been done with other sorts of detectors. In fact, in the first experiment that Joseph referred to about subdoppler cooling, we basically used this kind of a measurement to find out what the temperature was. But now with this detector, we've got all the individual particles, and so now we can talk about what the correlation looks like. Okay, so in operationally, what you do to get the correlation is you look at the number of pairs. You make a histogram of the number of pairs within some volume. And now the volume is a three-dimensional volume. So we make the volume fairly small. And we count how many pairs we get on each shot. There aren't a lot of pairs in such a volume. And so it's necessary to average that 1,000 times to get decent statistics. And what you see is this thing here. Again, the units here are milliseconds. These are number of pairs in this bin, in one of these bins. And what you see, this broad distribution, is simply the autoconvolution of this. Okay, it's not flat because there's a pulse of atoms that's falling down. So this unnormalized correlation function has to have this shape. The remarkable thing is inside this circle, because at very short relative distances, we have an excess compared to this simple smooth shape, which you would get if you just had some continuous blob falling past the detector. Okay? So you can now get out the normalized correlation function, which is a little easier to think about, by dividing this quantity by the autoconvolution of this one, essentially. And you get this. You get a thing that looks exactly like Henry Brown Twiss's experiment. And since we're not doing it with just two detectors, we're doing it with 10 to the fourth detectors, we can even do it in the XY plane. So this is the same type of correlation function, but now measured in the plane. Later, a few years later, okay, well, so that's for a thermal Bose gas. So what we did was we got the gas very cold, but we didn't let it condense into a BEC. If you do let it condense into a BEC, you've surely heard that, well, a BEC is almost like a laser, at least in the sense that, to a good approximation, all the particles are in the same mode, in the same state. And if that's true, then an argument similar to Glauber's would predict that there should not be any correlation. And sure enough, we were able to confirm that. And then you can do, so these are the two, this is Henry Brown Twiss's experiment, this is Arecki's experiment, done with de Broglie waves. And now we can do one thing that you can't do with photons. We can change the spin. So we can go to helium-3. We collaborated with some people in Amsterdam and got cold samples of helium-3. And sure enough, instead of getting a plus sign, we get a minus sign in this correlation, which, in a way, is simply a manifestation of the exclusion principle. The atoms don't like to be on top of each other. And so they avoid each other simply because of the exclusion principle. Nothing to do with any repulsion between the particles. They're neutral. They have only S-wave interactions, and fermions, their identical fermions, and the S-wave interactions vanish. So this is very close to an ideal gas, and it shows nice anti-correlations. Okay, you can talk about we spent a lot of time thinking about what the correlation really should be, but it's a little technical. It's not really that important to really understand exactly what the numbers are, but it works out very nicely. I'll take the time remaining to just describe a few other instances where this kind of experiment was done. Actually, before our work, the group of Emmanuel Bloch in Mainz did a very similar thing using optical detection and doing it in an optical lattice. And so in the optical lattice, it wasn't just a uniform blob or a Gaussian blob of particles, it was a lattice. And instead of seeing just a blob at the output, what they saw was the reciprocal lattice. Okay? And in particular, they demonstrate clearly that what you really see when you do this experiment is the Fourier transform of the density distribution that you started with. And then there were other experiments, which this was a nice experiment because it used a very fancy enhancement cavity to do the detection and got very nice very good discrimination or very good quantum efficiency for single atoms. And also it had the advantage that the experiment was done in a continuous way, much closer to the original Henry Brown Twiss idea, where you just look at the star, which is sending a stationary field, not in this pulsed way that we did. And the cold atom community is not the only one to do this. Here's an example that was done with electrons a few years ago now. A fancy electron source, highly coherent, and a detector similar to what we used, microchannel plates. And they managed to put to show that they had a very slight dip, a really tiny dip, in their in this pair distribution function at two detectors that are shown here, in this source that came from the electrons from this electron, this fancy field emission tip. The reason it was so small was because it was actually there's a problem of time resolution. The correlation time was very rapid, very fast, and so it was not easy to get a big signal. And it's actually also a fairly big business in heavy ion collisions. Indeed, in the heavy ion collision community, this has been under development since the late 50s. The idea was actually developed apparently completely independently of Hanbury-Round-Twiss's idea, but it's very similar. The idea is you smash together two things. Here's an example of two gold nuclei. They spit out stuff, in particular here, pions, and you can go and look at the correlations between pions that are going in nearly the same direction, and they see a very nice correlation as well. The units, this is now all relativistic. The formulas get very big and ugly, at least for me. And you plot this not in terms of times or positions, but in terms of this relativistic momentum. And what you get from this, what you get is the same thing you get when you look at the stars. At least that's what they think it is. Something related to the size of the volume that's emitting these pions. That is somewhat under debate. It's not completely clear how correct that is. And with that, I'll close with some remarks about what else you can do and what we'd like to do in the future. What I've said so far is all about ideal gases that do not interact. But with the exception of a gas of photons, perhaps, there is no such thing as an ideal gas. Gases always interact. And so for an ideal gas, I've sort of given you arguments, and you can make these much more precise, that this G2 function for a thermal gas will tell you something about the Fourier transform of the source distribution, whereas for an ideal BEC, it'll be completely uninteresting, it'll be perfectly flat. But in real situations, it's not true that the gas is ideal, and there ought to be corrections to this. In particular, it's a big issue in high-energy physics because it's for sure these particles have Coulomb interactions, maybe strong interactions that do things to the particles on the way out, or maybe even do things during the collision that do not admit an ideal gas approximation. And it's almost certain that in the case of cold atoms, and even in certain optical situations where you have a nonlinear medium, that there are also nonlinear interactions that could modify or distort the wavefronts and invalidate the analysis, this ideal gas analysis that I made. And there are some indications in our data that it doesn't the ideal, especially for the bosons, that this ideal gas approximation is not so good. And there are some discrepancies that do not appear to be coincidences. And this brings me to another. And so, indeed, if people who do BEC physics have long realized that actually these interactions, this interaction term, is what's interesting about BECs. And if I cast it in this way as a binary collision between particles 1 and 2, which are destroyed, and particle 3 and 4, which are created, it's something that looks like what quantum optics people like to call four-wave mixing. And this means, this sort of a Hamiltonian means that the normal processes that go on in this linear medium aren't just are complicated and are producing pairs. They're producing atoms or possibly other excitations in pairs. And this is really good news for us because what we really have, our detector is really a correlated pair detector. And if you look at the data that we can take, I'll give you a little example. Here is a three-dimensional reconstruction of a very complicated situation. It's a four-wave mixing situation in which we've taken three beams and let them crash, three BECs and let them crash into each other. They then produce a fourth one here, and they also produce a whole halo of stuff around it. And then since it's just software, it was a lot of work to just get the software to do this. You can look at this complicated object and walk around it. or have it turn around for you. And the correlations between all these points, every dot there corresponds to a detected atom, and the correlations between these dots have a lot of interesting information, and we're just beginning to try to mine that for what there is, what's in there. And some of the dreams we have for the future are shown here. You might be able to get these particles, to these pairs, to zip out of a condensate, and then do true quantum optics experiments, look at correlations between these experiments. This is an experiment that could actually, in principle, violate Bell's inequalities, proving that these things are really, truly entangled in a maximal way. A variant of this has been suggested recently to get measurements of order parameters in complicated many-body systems. And something that I'm thinking about a lot lately is a suggestion a few years ago that you might be able to simulate Hawking radiation in a sonic environment, making the sonic analog of a black hole. And this, in this situation, a nonlinearity similar to the one I just wrote down ought to be creating correlated phonons in such a system, which you ought to be able to detect with this kind of detector as well. And with that, I will close and thank you for your attention.